It is now noon. I would like to call this meeting to order. Deb Roush is not here today. I'm Joy Still, and I am going to be running this meeting. Stephanie, could we have a roll call, please?
Joy Still.
Here.
David Happ.
Here.
Cheryl Hanley Maxwell. Mike Smith.
Here.
Deb Roush.
Thank you. Are there additions to the agenda? Seeing none, hello. Seeing none, we will move on. Citizen input.
Hello, my name is Linda Tortorelli, and I wanted to follow up a little bit from last month's transition presentation with just a couple of follow-up points. And with the autism program, you know, I see lots of people with autism on a regular basis in our community. So last month, we highlighted the need for improvement in all areas of transition. Last night, we were at the CU Autism Network meeting trying to determine what is going to happen next with that group. One of the activities, there were 40 people that attended from a large cross-section of the community. We were thrilled to have professionals and parents of all ages and advocates that have autism that attended that meeting to give their input. Overwhelmingly, they wanted to continue some kind of autism-specific group, so a work group is going to be formed to look at what that might look like, so that's exciting. One of the other activities was to list people's, broke into small groups, to say what were some the priority needs for the community, and then what are the services that are here already. So out of that list, while there are many needs, the three top priorities, guess what was number one? The need for transition support and services for our youth aging out of schools. That was number one out of those 40 people that presented there. Number two was continued training education around autism, especially with the schools, along with that central way to get information, especially if TAP went away. People were really concerned about that. And number three was better access and more treatment options, especially for mental health and behavioral services like applied behavior analysis. So that was interesting to have that cross-section come away with those things and having transition again be loud and clear that it was a number one priority and need for our community. I just wanted to mention another takeaway I hope you gather from my presentation last month, that while funding is an issue, we all know that, just as important is an issue is that there's a lack of services and supports that one can purchase with the waiver funding once it's obtained. So imagine having a pile of gold nuggets, but what you need is cash to buy a loaf of bread at the grocery store. You can't go down to County Market with your gold nugget and buy bread. So it's not really that helpful sometimes to have waiver services that aren't accepted as a common currency in our community. So we need more ways that people can use their waiver services and that funding once they obtain it. So I wanted to highlight this with a situation that happened to me this week, which is not uncommon for me to have this happen at the autism program. A retired autism specialist with Unit 4 Schools contacted me about a situation where a young woman with significant AESD had aged out of our school district and had no supports. The young woman and her mother are African American and very low SES. This is something that we mentioned last month that I know Dr. Hanley mentioned as, like, what about the ones that can't navigate the services? So this was one that she had brought two advocates with her, that she has no transportation, she lives in subsidized housing, she had been homeless at one point. So this was a mom that at least had found an advocate to help her at this critical moment. So when this family had been homeless, the school district, DSC, and other agencies rallied around and helped stabilize that family. So they were known to these agencies. This child thrives and needs significant structure to be successful. The child aged out, as I mentioned, without funding, and they were told by DSC that they could not serve her without funding, so she has not been served for the last year. A case manager from DSC continued to attend the IEP until the time of transitioning out of school, and the parent continues to sign papers once a year at DSC for case management, so they are open with this agency, yet she's not getting services. The young adult has now been home for a while. Mother cannot work, and the young woman has grown more and more difficult to handle without structure. She's refused to eat because she's angry she cannot go to school. I was with her. She is very malnourished at this point, and they're trying to figure out ways to encourage her to eat. But all she will verbalize is that she's angry she can't go to school. She refuses to use her visual supports or communication system because of her anger of not having that structure. She is now dangerously thin. When mom tries to take her into the community, she becomes agitated, so they are limiting their time out of their small housing unit. Now, I'm kind of happy to say this young woman is about to receive home-based waiver services. She is considered critical, and she is working through the process, and she will receive this funding very shortly. I spent almost 2 hours with this mom, daughter, and advocate attempting to explain how the waiver works, which was not easy. This young woman needs 9-to-3 programming. She needs that level of structure. Mom has been checking with DSC to see if they'll provide services, and then, you know, and how does this waiting list that this daughter has been on for so long work? Where am I? Do I have a number? You know, and nobody can really explain to mom how the waiting list works. So if you recall last month, Annette Becker spoke about how DSC was helping a transitioning youth from Urbana receive DSC services with DDB funding, which is wonderful. Yay. But while this is great for the Urbana student, you know, you've got to scratch your head. So why didn't this girl on the waiting list that's also as critical receive services? So it's something that advocates like myself have been completely frustrated over, trying to understand how to access services. How does this DDB funding work within agencies? How come some people get it and other people don't? There are people on waiting lists. Why don't they get it or be contacted even when their cases are open? We're anxiously awaiting the opening of the new CTF Advocacy Center for more options. That will be a center that you can use waiver services for or private pay as well, or use DT funding for. So we're anxious for that center to get open and get started so we do have more options in the community shortly. I do think that for an agency that receives $3 million a year from our local tax revenue, that we do have a right to know and influence how these dollars are being made available to the neediest people and have a right to know how these systems work and how to access them and how to help parents navigate these really complicated systems. If you recall the case manager that said that, you know, they sit at these IEPs meetings and DSC says, well, if you don't have funding, it doesn't mean you won't be served, and if you do have funding, it doesn't mean that we'll serve you, just leaves everyone with a sense of utter frustration about how to get access to more supports and services in the community. Thank you. Joyce, do you have a question before I leave?
No.
I'm Vicki Tall from Developmental Services Center. I wish we could work together. I wish that when you were talking to that family, maybe you would have called me. That person is not on our wait list. Mother has never asked for her daughter to be on the wait list until yesterday. I wish we could communicate, Linda.
I wish we could communicate as well. And I wish that when you send people to IEP meetings and they're trying to come up with transition plans, that there's an understanding of what can be offered. And so this saying that just because you have funding, you don't get services, and just because you don't get them, leaves everybody going, I don't know what that means. I don't know.
And how do you know that that was really said? It's not said.
I've been to meetings when that's been said. I've been to them myself when that's been said.
Well, I just want to clarify that that person is not on our wait list. She never has been. Mom has never said she wanted her on until yesterday. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Kyla Chantos. I'm the Advocacy Center Coordinator for CTF Illinois, which Linda referenced. And I just wanted to give a quick update. We do have our building. We had our fire marshal inspection. We are awaiting our DHS inspection, so we should be receiving a call here within the next week, week and a half, for our inspection. When we do receive it, we'll be opening the doors. We've been doing some screenings. We've been doing interviews, and there's a lot of potential clients coming, but we've got to get those doors open, and that should be happening soon here, like I said, within the next week and a half. Questions? Okay. Thank you.
Where's the building?
It is on Round Barn Road across the street from the Driver's Bureau. So it's in the brick buildings across the street. It's kind of two office doors down from the Tappan Leadership Academy.
All right, moving on. Anyone else? Okay. CCMHB input? Is there any?
The CCMHB is meeting at 5:30 today. Also here, sort of a similar light, very light business, but we have a mid-year presentation from a new program during this meeting, and then we have a mid-year presentation from a new program on the Mental Health Board portfolio, and I think those are really interesting. We haven't done those before. I'm looking forward to that. Otherwise, not a heavy meeting.
Okay, thank you. Moving on, could I have a motion for approval of the minutes of the last meeting, please?
Move to approve. Second.
All in favor of approval? Well, anyone want to discuss anything on those minutes? Nope. Good. Okay. We'll go ahead. All in favor of accepting those as put in our packet, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Passes. Okay. Secretary's comments. That would be me. So I'm going to go forward on this. I understand the real frustration of people not getting the services that they need. I hope we won't have something where we are going one agency against another on this. It will do no one any good. What we really need is an understanding of what actually has to happen as far as all of these things are concerned. Money is not coming from the state of Illinois. They are so far behind on their payments. We have funding that we can give out to agencies, which we do, hopefully on the best way we possibly can do that. We need to keep more people. We need to bring them into the system, but money is not there. So what we have to do is be sure that the people that we are serving at this point do not lose their services, as well as advocate for the people that need service and aren't able to get them. It is, as a parent, very frustrating to know that your child is not getting service that they need. And especially if you do get that golden ticket, as they say, I don't know how to describe it other than it seems like an effort that nobody is taking seriously at the state level. I think all our agencies are trying to do the best they can with the money that they get. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to add people to those roles of people that are getting the service without money. There isn't any coming in. So we need to keep that in mind. And we also need to know that all of us are wanting the very same things. It isn't about competition between agencies as far as the service that they provide. It's about what we can actually do to provide direct service. One of the things that I have been against for a while, we are not doing this coming year, which is funding EbertFest. I think those folks will probably be okay with that. But I think every penny that we put forward in this coming year, we need to be very careful about, and we'll go ahead and really work hard to do that. Also, I have discovered that we have a guest today, and I think, tell me if I'm wrong, it's Dr. Brian Daig. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And he is a consultant from the University of Vermont. He was hired through the Employment First grant, and later on we'll be hearing from him. And we're very happy to have you. Thank you for being here. Okay, that's pretty much it. Let's move on to Executive Director's report.
So first, I'd like to introduce the new liaison from the county board, which is the county board chair, Pius Weibel. He's been with us before, but not in this capacity, so welcome. I'll do quick updates. We have accelerated the timeline for our organizational assessment because of staff vacancies. Our focus has been very internal for the last few weeks, but we've made a lot of progress and hope to be able to incorporate what we've learned really quickly. So yay for that. I've had some discussions with some agency representatives about problems with the strict definition of DD that's in our funding guidelines. So I hope next month to take a look at that with a briefing memo, and you can see what the references are, and we can talk about the impact. I'm going to hopefully this week collect information or begin to request information about the impact on the agencies who are providing services. We also have had some conversations with the Expo coordinator. There's not an update today from the Expo coordinator because it's too early in the cycle, but we are thinking about moving the Expo to next April instead of doing it in October. And I have a long list of reasons from the coordinators for why they think that might be better timing and maybe work better for the boards too. So system enhancements. During December, I worked on some enhancements to our online application system. The one that I think would be of most interest to the public is a public page where you can look at sort of an overview of everything the boards are currently funding. And because of the alphabet, the DD board investments are first. So it's just go to the welcome page of our application site, which is ccmhddbrds.org. And there's a link in that welcome paragraph that will take you to that information. I think that's a nice overview, and I'm happy that we can make it available now. We might add priorities to it so that you can see what funding priorities each of those investments relate to. Otherwise, there is the only other item I need to bring up is that we have an optional study session booked for next Wednesday evening. It could be used by either the DD board or the mental health board or both. That we're in the little room next door, so it might be a tough one if we had a big presentation. But two topics that we could consider are a training on on the application review process itself and ideas that board members might have to make it better. The Mental Health Board is especially overwhelmed with reviews of applications during April. I haven't gotten the sense from the DD Board that they're that overwhelmed, but you might have suggestions for improving the system anyway. So that's one topic. Another possible topic would be a training for newer board members, because there are a few newer board members, including Pius. So anyway, if you have an interest in booking a study session on either one of those topics, we'll also talk about it tonight. And that's it.
Okay, staff report, Chandra.
I just wanted to let you know the resource guide that the students did is in the staff report in the packet. If you have any addition or corrections, it can be edited and distributed as well. Are there any questions specifically about my report? Yes.
I don't know. I want to know where this will be available to people. Where can people go to get the guide?
We can upload it to our site, because we also put the Disability Expo resource guide, so it can be actually up on our website and also on the Alliance pages as well.
Okay. Can we get a copy in the libraries, in the Champaign and
yes,
and
I can.
Libraries?
Yes.
I just like to say that I think this is really valuable information, and the students who did this, we owe a great thanks to. Any chance I can get a place to send a thank you note from you?
Yeah, I can give you their email addresses, and we can get their contact information.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay, moving on. Agency information.
Good afternoon, everybody. Patty Walters at DSC. I have several things that I wanted to just update and share, and I'm feeling as I was preparing for this meeting that some of my comments are quite timely. Transition presentation last month, I wasn't able to be present for that and wanted to recognize the work that Linda, Jim, Mayor, Annette Becker, and I know Chandra was very involved in. The PowerPoint information looks to be a really good tool to help us develop a plan to improve transition process in Champaign County. I did note that the page referencing adult agencies and supports, I'm sure unintentionally, did not include DSC. So as a provider in the community, we want to make sure that that's in there. I saw the employment one. I saw the employment services where we were all listed, and then I saw the adult service agencies and didn't see a DSC, so it seemed like
Sense. But you got a whole page with everything that you offered. So that was my bad that I didn't read Dundee and put you on the other page. So.
Or just incorporate it all together. I just wanted to reference that for anybody that's using the tool. So obviously, I just wanted to reiterate that I do think that it's a good tool and a good resource, and that we definitely want to be a part of the work group or subcommittee that that is trying to improve transitions for adult services in Champaign County, and I hope that this is a welcome collaboration. A point of clarification, I hear routinely that people are encouraged to call DSC and be put on the waiting list, that there isn't anything available. I did hear this morning or this afternoon that there's concerns about our presence and our presentation and comments at IEPs. We won't ignore that. We'll take that to heart, and I'd like to consider that constructive criticism. I'm also wondering about RPC's role in this process, because they need to be a good resource for families that are struggling with how to access services, that there's certainly a venue for that and a good resource. But I did want to explain that when especially the board and the staff, when they see the number of people that are served from DSC or by DSC, those numbers remain fairly constant over the years, but there are new people served every year. There's people that exit the programs. There's people that receive state funding, and so they are transitioning away from Champaign County dollars, which opens up opportunities for people that are on the wait list or the people that approach DSC for services. I do have some numbers that I put together. I think it's probably more information than for agency information, but while the numbers remain constant, I do, have program information that show that there's lots of activity. And I know, Lynn, when you guys do site visits, you see that. You observe that there are new people served every quarter or nearly every quarter in almost every program. There are wait lists. The dollars, we knew from the very beginning, do not meet the need of every single person needing services in Champaign County. As one provider, we do our best. We are really open to referring people to other services. We encourage them to see what else is available in every other agency provider in the town. I hope everybody is doing that too. Even back when the waiting list was really all that was happening, we would encourage people to get on every single program list they could in the community, and they can always say no to somebody if they don't want the service, but make sure that you're informed and that you know what's available out there, and we need to be good resources for each other and referral sources for each other. So I do have some numbers available. That's something that I can share another time, or if you want me to send an email or something, I'm happy to do that. I know you see that information kind of quarterly, but collectively, looking back over the last 10 years, I think that it's really impressive and worth sharing. I also wanted to let you know that as Joyce mentioned, that Dr. Daig is here with us, and he's going to talk during the E-First agenda item. He is the consultant that was hired through the collaboration with Community Choices and DSC, funded through DDB, and we did intentionally plan his visit so that he could attend a meeting and share kind of the progress to date. We're working with him through at least June of this year. A quick reference to some other activities scheduled that are directly linked to DDB-funded programs. He is going to be working with our employment specialist team this Thursday doing a one-day customized employment. And in February, there's a three-day training that is scheduled with Griffin and Hammes. Bob Nemec from Griffin and Hammes Associates is doing three-day customized employment training that includes DSC staff, Community Choices staff, other local providers, and we may have a few slots to open up to other agencies that we've worked with. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Can you extend that offer to the CTF vocational team?
I think everybody's been invited.
Okay, it
was sent to, or handed out at the TPC meeting last week, I know. And so that's one venue. And then I think we're doing a little bit more outreach because we've got a few seats available. So I think we've got the capacity for up to 30 people. And that is happening. What are the dates on that?
That's a great dream.
February 14th, 15th, 16th. We had hoped that maybe there would be some representation from the schools with that, but I think that those dates, you know, the school week, that we're not going to be able to benefit from that. But we definitely recognize that that would be something that would be helpful in the future. Lastly, I just wanted to share that I currently serve on and have been for a few years, the Division of Developmental Disabilities Statewide Quality Committee, and we're hosting a 4-regional person-centered practice forum for providers across the state. The DHS is the one that sent the invites for that. Director Fenton, Jama Bernard Page from the Bureau of Quality and Management, a self-advocate and 3 community providers recognized in the state for their perspective on person-centered practices, will be speaking, and that includes DSC, Ray Graham, and Trinity Services. So we are very excited to be a part of that and really to be recognized as a resource to other providers in Illinois, and thought that was worth sharing this morning. So any questions? I know that was a mouthful. Yes, ma'am.
Where would these things be located?
The trainings?
Correct.
The one this Thursday is just for DSC employment specialists, and then the one that is scheduled, it's at the iHotel, in February.
Okay.
And I believe that Annette has a flyer over here that has the details, information about that particular forum.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's move on to approval of claims, please. Oh, there is someone. Oh, Becca,
okay.
I'm looking this way.
No worries. I'm Becca Obachowski with Community Choices. Lynn spoke to this a little bit earlier in her comments, but I just thought I would speak a little bit about the impact of some of the eligibility criteria for funding for many of the programs through the DDB board. So Community Choices in part was founded by people and families who are impacted by developmental disability that may or may not include an intellectual disability. Specifically, this is people with autism spectrum disorder, ASD, which is categorized as a developmental disability, but may not include an intellectual disability. These people often fall through the cracks, and we wanted to make sure that some of our programs, when we conceptualized them, were designed to support these people so that they could become more independent and hopefully be able to receive service and then go on to sort of not need as much in the future. Currently, in order to participate in these programs, which were sort of designed in that way, folks need to get onto the PUNS list, which would often face, So they often can get onto the PUNS list, but what can happen is that if they were then pulled for state-funded services, they may no longer actually qualify for those. So that would put them in the position where they had been receiving, you know, services funded through the county, through you folks, but then when they were actually pulled for services from the state, if they didn't meet the actual criteria, they would then be left not being able to get state services or be able to get county services. We looked at sort of the list of people that we serve. We have about 65 members of the cooperative who with disabilities. We serve other people who are not members of the cooperative. But of those 65 or so people, about a third fall into this category where, yes, they may be on the PUNS list now, but if they were to get pulled for services, there's a good chance that they would face real challenges in order to get those state-funded services, leaving them potentially a situation where they would lose all services. So they still have a significant need, and being part of our programs, I think that they've shown that they can be have the benefit from receiving those services. You know, what we'd like is for the board to consider sort of looking at what some of those eligibility criteria are, and perhaps right now the Regional Planning Commission, they do a lot that pre-screening. What we would ask is that potentially Regional Planning might be able to, or another organization would be able to say, like, well, this person, you know, they're on PUNS, but we can also verify that they have a developmental disability such as autism and should then be eligible for services that were designed to support people such as themselves. So I can certainly speak more about this in future meetings if you guys are considering it as a board. But do you have questions?
Just that a couple of years ago, two things changed. And at that point, I asked the agencies to go back and take people who either had been rejected before or anticipated being rejected, so they never approached the PASS agency for the service, to go back because two things changed. The state changed the determinations it was making on behalf of people with autism spectrum disorders, started to approve people for funding who they had not even considered before. So that was a big deal. The other thing that changed is the DDB started paying the Regional Planning Commission, ISC unit, to do that eligibility determination at the time of PUNS enrollment or update. So everybody who's on the PUNS, if they go for their annual update, should be getting that eligibility. It's a sort of a presumptive eligibility screening. So that's available to people. So I need to make sure that everybody's tried that first before we open up our eligibility rules, because our rules are based on state statute, and it's a little tricky to change the state statute. We could, maybe there's room for interpretation, but before we do that, I'd like to see that everybody has taken the opportunity, if it's appropriate, for a redetermination. Now, recently I've learned that the state actually expects the ISCs to be doing that. So if the state is now funding that activity, then maybe the RPC could do something different for us through that contract. But that I have yet to get verification on that.
Yeah, and so. I'll just say too, you know, we always encourage people to get onto the PUNS list and to access state services whenever possible. There's just some of the people that we work with where I do worry that, that they could potentially lose services as a result of getting denied state funding. So just kind of a group of people that we, I think definitely have a need and that we attempt to serve and want to make sure that the doors for those services remain open. Any other questions?
Hi. My name is Dylan Brooks. I work at PACE. I will do my best to be as clear as possible. But again, if you are not understanding me, just wait for it and I will repeat myself. I have a couple of things I want to bring up. The first is last year I was hit with a lot of health issues from April through October. I was hospitalized 6 times and I had 4 surgeries. So, unfortunately, that had a negative effect on my ability to provide services to my consumers. So I wanted the board to be aware that apparently getting over with cerebral palsy is not all that's good to be. The second thing that I wanted to bring to your attention is one of my most consistent consumers, and a consumer that I've provided many hours of service to in the past was found to be no longer eligible by RPC. I'm here used to be eligible, but surgery that he had fixed his seizure disorder, so he no longer has seizures connected with his epilepsy. Because of that, he was confirmed to be no longer eligible, so I'm in the position of trying to continue to provide services to this consumer through other funding sources. The issue that I want to bring to the board's attention is this consumer had seizures for the majority of his life, close to 30 years of seizures, and those seizures caused deficits which are still there. Those deficits did not go away when the seizures went away. So I want to encourage the board, much like Rebecca just did, to look at the criteria and the qualifications that are in place and look at the consumers that are falling through the cracks and encourage you to try to find ways to broaden your own criteria. I hope that was clear enough for you guys. Any questions?
It might be clear to me because I've been on this journey with you, and on behalf of that person, Dylan requested a reconsideration and it was denied again. So I think that is a case when I'm asking the agencies for information about the impact. I think Becca will be able to provide me some information about people who could be better served, or, you know, maybe we need to fund something different. I don't know, but we will get stories like that, hopefully. I'm going to hopefully send a letter to you all soon to collect that kind of information. And I mean, I'm aware of some cases, but I don't think I'm aware of the full impact. Okay.
Any other questions for Dylan? Thank you, Dylan. Anyone else with agency information? All right, thank you. All right, we're going to move on to the financial report. Approval of claims. Could I have a motion, please?
So moved. Second.
Any discussion? Okay. All in favor of accepting these as presented, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Passed. Okay. We're going to move on to new business. This is a mid-year report on the program for microboards and cooperatives, and Vicki Nyswander is going to be speaking with us about that. And Amy Slager.
See if I can make this computer work. I need that mouse over there. So as Jay said, I'm Vicki Nyswander, and I think everybody knows me pretty well. Amy, you might want to say a few words about yourself.
My name's Amy Slagle. I'm new to the IAMC, and I have two kids with autism spectrum disorder, and just happy to be here, I guess.
And we're happy to have her. So we're really excited to be able to present some information about our project here today. And I know the meeting probably ran a little bit longer, so we'll try and hurry things along. But I'm inviting you all, if you have questions as we go, I think we'd rather deal with questions as we go rather than wait till the end. So I just want to start by saying that based upon the research and based upon our experiences in working over the past 10 years, and the IAMC has been in Illinois for the last 10 years, we believe that even people with the most significant disabilities can have a better quality of life based on real person-centered planning and community inclusion as long as they get the necessary supports. And we have seen communities benefit as well. I think it's a two-way street. So we have been in Illinois for 10 years. The idea of microboards and cooperatives has been in existence for more than 40 years, mainly in Canada and other countries around the world. So this is not by any means a new concept, except for those of us here in Illinois. A microboard, and I'm just going to give a brief definition of both of the structures that we use because they're kind of the basis of the work that we're doing with this grant. The microboard is the incorporated version of our work in Champaign County. So we are building teams that revolve around an individual person. The team is like a think tank. It's people from the family, people from the community who get together, people who care about that person to help them figure out strategies and supports and ways to connect in a community. It can serve as a service provider. We have 5 microboard CILAs in the state, none currently in Champaign County, but one of our teams is actually considering becoming a microboard CILA. We have more than 50 microboards statewide who are ready to become providers when the budget finally allows for it, which probably won't be anytime soon. It is, and as the picture indicates, it is not atypical for a microboard meeting to include somebody joining by Skype, because our families are pretty spread out across the country and not everyone is always able to be there in person. So the next shot is one of our cooperatives up in the Chicago area. Cooperatives, just in short, because they aren't really what we're doing here with our grant, but we have formed a dozen of these across the state, and they are groups that come together to share their supports and services. The focus is mainly on employment, alternative housing options, and social opportunities, and it's all community-based. The biggest difference is that the board of directors of the cooperative is made up of the people who are served by the group rather than just people from the community who want to do a good thing. So we are started in this venture about a year and a half, almost 2 years ago, with the EPIC Project, which is was located in Pike County, about an hour west of Springfield. This project here in Champaign, Building Inclusive Communities, is a replication of that project. Now, EPIC continues to function on a volunteer basis because the funding ran out on that, but so we still work together with them on a regular basis while they seek more funding. I want to talk a little bit about how we think about relationships and building teams and how that affects the teams that we're working with. So as we're looking at relationships, we talk about first the people who really care about the individual on a very personal level. So family members, people that you love, and people who love you that are in that main circle, parents, children, siblings, those are the people that you find most frequently in that inner circle. The next circle out is the circle of friendship. And so in this circle, if you were going to make one of these for yourselves, you would write the names of the people that you see one-on-one on a regular basis, people that you have coffee with, people that you make phone calls to that are your go-to people when times are tough or when times are good. The next circle includes organizations. This is the circle of participation. So if you belong to a club, if you belong to, say, a board of directors, if you belong to a sports team, if you belong to a choir and you sing at your church or, you know, a member of your church, those are the things that belong in that circle. And then the last circle are the people who serve you because they get paid to do that. So doctors, dentists, teachers, therapists, you name it, anybody who actually gets a check at the end of the week for serving individuals with disabilities. And everybody can fill one of these circles out, and it kind of covers the broad scope of where people are in the community and who are the people that you know. And we use this tool when we're talking to families because, honestly, some families are a little bit isolated. And their kid has been isolated, maybe even self-isolated. You know, we don't know that. But when they think about, you know, who is the one person that they could invite to be a part of their kid's person-centered plan, they say, I don't know anybody. I don't have any friends. And so that becomes a real challenge, and we really have to explore where those people are. And they're usually out there, but they don't really think of that initially. They just say, well, I can't do this because we're too isolated. The other thing we use to address in this particular exercise is to think about the community as a much broader opportunity than a typical than the service provider world. So when you think about service providers, they do a very good job of offering parts of the community to people with disabilities, but they don't have the money, they don't have the staff, and they don't have the connections necessarily to meet the needs of every individual person who's got such a broad variety of needs in their life. And so that's what we're trying to do with this team concept. So just one more example of how this might work. So you've got a person with a disability who is maybe not connected except to their group home, their workshop or day program, and then there might be special activities that take them out into the community. So we start by adding the family and maybe a friend into the circle and doing a plan, and lo and behold, we find out that they're connected to different places in the community, and they know other people. And so when we start exploring options for those individuals, we might invite a person that somebody else knows to come in and talk about a club that they belong to or a potential activity that this person might enjoy, and then their community just grows over time. And before you know it, we have a really vibrant team that is really engaged and creative and helping people to become a more active part of their world and making a contribution to their community. So we're going to give you some examples of some of the paths that we've done. PATH, meaning Planning Alternative Tomorrows with Hope. And this is the person-centered planning process that we've used. And just to let you know, we have gotten permission of all the participants whose paths we are showing. We have written permission to do that. So this is the first PATH that we did. And this is a man with autism who is living in his own apartment, but he doesn't do much. He stays at home, and his parents wanted to they were very excited about building a team and having him engaged with this. But Dad said, well, you know what? When you ask him what his hopes and dreams are, he's going to say, I don't know. So I talked to him about a week ahead of time, and I said, hey, you know, we're going to talk about this. This is about, you know, making your life better. And so I want you to think a little bit about what your hopes and dreams are for the future. What does your perfect life look like? So we came to the meeting, and Dad's going, oh, boy, this isn't going to work. You know, he's not going to say anything. So I said, okay, tell me, what are your hopes and dreams for the future? And he pulled out his phone, and he said, I have a list. And on the list were some of the things that you may recognize on the path under the North Star, which is on the far right-hand side of the path. He says, I want to go on a trip to Japan. I want to hike in the mountains in Wyoming. I want to work as a vet tech for a veterinarian. I want to learn how to cook. I want to learn how to play the piano. I want to have more friends. And I want to have a girlfriend. His dad and his mom were blown away. And so we started putting the plan in place to make that happen. Now, since he was the very first person to join the grant, he's had a couple of follow-up meetings, which is an important part of this process. You can't just do a plan and roll it up in the corner and stick it in the, you know, or stick it in a closet and expect all that stuff's going to happen. So now he is working to save money for his trip to Japan. He is been trained as a volunteer at the Humane Society. He's connected with Japan House on campus, and they have a weekly tea ceremony. And I don't know that he's gone to one yet, but that's in the plan, too. So we're meeting next week, and we'll find out how that progress is going. He's cooking at least one meal a week from scratch. Really interesting stuff. Tater tot casserole was one of them. Even with his anxiety, he's really working hard to connect with people he knows so that he can make some new friends. A shorter-term goal that he has is taking a trip to Cedar Point in Ohio and going with a friend.
Okay. So just a few more examples of paths that we've done. This one is a person named, her title is G Monster, Taking on the World, and the team kind of comes up with the name of the path at the end. So Jillian is the gal in question. She lives in her own home and has recently been hired to work a few hours a week for a local dentist. The focus of her path was to help her gain more independent living skills, like establishing a routine, cooking her own meals, and safely using transportation options. Her team also expressed a need for Jillian to have a better and more connections with friends. That's it. Okay. The next one we're showing is a gal named Heather, and she is going to be turning 22 in April. So her team is developing plans to start a microboard and possibly become a Scylla provider for Heather and one or two of her friends. In the meantime, they are interviewing and hiring support workers that they hope will come together in the next 6 weeks to help Heather in plan her life beyond school. Currently, the team is looking at volunteering, regular exercise, participation in social events, and connecting regularly with her friends. The next path is Abby. Abby is also still in high school, and at their last team meeting, the team developed transition goals that reflect Abby's needs as she exits the school district, such as gaining new skills for independent living, having access to transportation, technology, and staying connected to her friends. The team will also focus on a smooth transition of supports from the school to DRS. They are currently seeking funding to provide individualized supports after graduation. The next path is Alex. And Alex is a young woman with autism who is an aspiring author. She was homeschooled, and she has very few connections to people her age and limited community connection. Only three people attended her path. It was Alex, her mom, and her grandfather. As you can see from the long list in the second column where it says enroll, there are a number of possibilities for recruiting additional team members. The goal for now is to increase her team to provide more ideas and connections for Alex to help her achieve her hopes and dreams.
And actually, we had a team meeting with Alex and her mom last night, and surprised to find another community member in attendance who came up with offering to take Alex to get her Dash Pass the next day, because mom just hasn't had time to do that. So I looked at mom and I said, see, this is why we want team members. This is why we need community members. Mom can't do it all.
Yeah. So, and one final one that we're going to show is Amrai. And Amrai is also going to be exiting the school system soon. She loves to cook, and she's had a job at the bakery in the past. Her path team included a family friend and her parents, and then there were five siblings who lived all over the place, including one international, and they were able to join via Google Hangouts. And her team is focused on Amrai becoming more independent, such as traveling to see her siblings is one of her big goals. And they want her to learn safety skills, like how to express when she needs something and being aware of what's going on around her so she can stay safe.
So the process that we use is we meet with a family initially just to talk about what the grant offers to them and how it works and the importance of getting other community members involved. Then we, in another meeting, have those people come together and do the path, which is about a two-hour process. And we talk about hopes and dreams, and it's a backward planning kind of a process where you talk about what you're going to do long term, and then what can we accomplish in the next year, in the next month, in the next couple of days, and who are the people to enroll. So all of those pieces are critical. Every path, the structure of it really does look the same, but the content is always very unique and different based on the individual. Then we have a monthly follow-up meeting. We schedule the meeting before we leave the room so that we have a follow-up meeting, come back and revisit, talk about what our celebrations are, what are the challenges that we've had, what's on the to-do list for the next month, and schedule another date. The purpose is, you know, you want to keep pushing forward, because if you give up on that path, if you give up on those hopes and dreams, they're not going to happen, or at least not as easily as it does if you really keep working toward them. The next goal will be to have monthly follow-up meetings with the teams with periodic or remote support. So once they are strong enough and consistent enough to be able to do their meetings on their own, then we will start backing off that approach. We haven't done that yet because we've only been going for 6 months. But that ultimately is the goal. And then at the very end point, independently facilitated meetings. And by the time somebody would decide to be a micro board and take this on full time and have funding to do, you know, hire a staff person to run a SILA if that's what they choose, then we would be there for phone calls and occasional, you know, if they need some help with their meeting, we could do that. But the goal is we back off services for some people, and then we can take new people on long term. So current status, 7 teams have completed their path. 5 of those teams have had 1 or more follow-up meetings. I think that's actually 6 now. We had one yesterday. And we have 4 more paths scheduled for January and February. We have 3 teams that are interested in doing a path, but they have not yet scheduled. And we've had 12 requests from people who don't qualify for services. Seems to be a reoccurring theme today, but we're talking about people with autism who haven't been able to get on PUNS, or people with mental health issues. That's the other group. And honestly, it's a process that could be beneficial for anybody who is needy in some way, who needs support somehow. I even had a conversation a couple of years ago with a counselor from Greenville State Hospital who said this micro board thing would be a great thing for people exiting prison. I said, yeah, that's right. He says, can you do that? And I said, no, our funding comes from the DD system. So unless the person has that, we can't help. So finishing up the year, we're going to be trying to find opportunities to bring some of our teams together so that they can share their successes, their resources, and build upon that with each other. We're going to be doing a lot more collaboration with some of the providers, most of whom are here in the room. We're going to be providing opportunities for training for the teams and the community at large. Some of you have heard of David Wetherow. He is the mentor for our project and has been doing so at no cost to us for a very long time. We're going to bring him to do a day's training on team building and the team concept, probably in late April, early May. We haven't yet set a date. We're trying to do that in collaboration with some of the other trips that he's taking around the country. And we're going to be helping one of the micro board Scylla team interested in doing that training. We've been in contact with DDD to find out when their next training is, and that's not scheduled yet. And we're also talking with some folks about training their personal support workers to better work in this community-based model. And then last step is we hope to establish an advisory committee of well-connected community members, probably some of the people who are serving on those individual teams, to help give us a little bit better guidance as we move forward. And that's it. Questions? Comments? Really?
I don't have a question for you, but this is very interesting to me, and I think it does give families and the person involved some real guidelines as far as how to go about doing something like this. So it's looking good at this point.
I do want to say that having a team probably isn't for every person or every family. It does take commitment to do, and it really is for the people who want something more than what is currently offered in our communities.
Yeah, I think it also takes people who are willing to put in the time to do it, and that isn't always an easy thing to get, you know. And for many people, I would think that the amount of time commitment to actually doing this is probably intimidating at the beginning, but that's pretty much what parents do over and over.
I was just going to say, you know, we do that, Joyce.
I know.
You know, we do that. And so having that extra support means that you and I don't have to live one day longer than our kid.
I know. I'm well aware of that. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Any questions from anyone? No. Okay, thank you.
Okay,
thank
sure.
you very much. I didn't mean to sound like Elvis there, but thank you very much. Okay. Let's move on. This would be integration transition successes. Do we have any report on that from anyone?
Becca Obachowski again with Community Choices. I just wanted to update you guys on a couple things that have happened since the last meeting. We had one individual who's been part of our community living program for a little more than 2 years, for a while, who has just transitioned out of the program and so now is basically on a consultation basis where she can still contact us if she needs some support, but she is living in her own apartment. She's working in the community. She's connected with a number of outside groups, including her church, including some friends, as well as joining some clubs, including the Toastmasters Club, which meets weekly at the Champaign Library. And she just gave her first speech to the group, I think last week or the week before. And so that has been a group that's been very, very welcoming for her. So she's been able to sort of move out, become independent, and really get connected with things that are very important to her. We also, sort of about the community living department, we looked back and over half of the people in that program did vote in the last election. So that was something that we were very, very excited to help advocate and help get people the knowledge that they needed to get out there and do that for themselves and for democracy. We also had an individual who recently went through our job discovery process and really expressed interest in working with children. And we've just gotten her a job, helped her get a job at Ducky Daycare in Monticello, which is something she's really excited about. She should be starting next week. And then I know that Brian Degg with DSU is going to be presenting about their Employment First updates and things, but I just wanted to say that last week at our monthly family meeting, Chike Coleman from DSU presented with our lead employment specialist, Ashley, about Employment First, about WIOA, and about sort of our collaboration and what we're doing in the community to support those efforts. So it's been a good month.
Good. Thank you. Okay. Old business. Oh, no. Annette.
A few months ago, I shared about a group of self-advocates who put together a presentation, peer training for Expect the Best, how to get the most out of your support staff. And they presented at the Speak Up, Speak Out Summit, and it was very well received. Last week, they were asked to speak to the all-staff meeting for the Illinois Department of Developmental Disabilities. And many people, including Director Fenton, encouraged them to continue to share the message and said they really appreciated it. They are doing a webinar with the Alliance next week. They're going to be on the disability beat at the end of the month. And in April, they will be presenting at the ARC annual conference. And then also we have signed a lease for a property on 110 East University in Champaign. And if you drive by there, you'll see that they have taken down the front of the building. We're in the process of renovating that property, and we will be using it as an art space, hopefully opportunities for self-employment, starting with our Enactus group, and we're very excited. We also have had some contact with the art community in Champaign, and they're going to be supporting us in that process.
Anyone else? Thank you. Okay, we're at Old Business Employment First Update. Mr. Degg.
Hi, thank you. I'm Brian Degg. I'm with the University of Vermont Center on Disability and Community Inclusion. And Vermont was able to successfully close down their sheltered workshops in 2002. As a result of that, what we started doing was hosting Sheltered Workshop Conversion Institute in 2007, and we've been repeating that every other year. And that's where I met folks from the DSC, who a number of them attended our institute in 2015, and have since contacted me to provide some training and technical assistance around the conversion effort. As you may know, it's a national movement now to really kind of move away from sheltered workshops to more community-based employment. So we've been doing a number of consulting and training around the country in addition to our Conversion Institute. So as part of that process, I did a visit in, I came in June and kind of got some tours and got to see what their services were, and then came back in November, and we went through the PATH process that was just described in the previous presentation. It's an excellent tool for organizational change as well, although we didn't come up with a fancy name for it the way those guys did. I'll have to work on that. So the staff collected, and we did a full 2 days of going through this PATH process where we did the same thing of looking to the future, like where do we want, what do we want DSC services to look like in the future, and then kind of working your way backwards and going through the same process of sort of where are we now in our services, you know, who can we include in the journey, and the ways to build strength, and then kind of breaking it down into systematic plan. So that's what we're in the process of doing right now. So we went through a rather extensive process, and and I think the result was really good in terms of looking at where the agency is and where we want to go. A lot of it is a real culture shift, as a lot of agencies are going through that have been established for a number of years of providing sheltered work and kind of moving that into the community. It's a pretty big process and kind of a daunting process. And a lot of it is just has to do with the systems change. You know, my doctoral work was looking at the families and their involvement of going through the process. And one of the things I saw with that, and we're seeing here in a number of agencies, is that there is definitely a generational issue there. You have a lot of more of the traditional families that have been used to facility services and kind of want to hang on to that. But then you have younger families coming in that really want a completely different array of services. So it's how do you look at, shifting that culture, the culture and also the services to match, what we're going to need to do in the future. So one of the things that I've been just incredibly impressed with the staff is their dedication and readiness and willingness to move forward with this process. A lot of times, some of the places I've done some consulting, you get a lot of pushback. People maybe are not ready for the change, but I've been very impressed that the staff, is very much ready, willing, and able to move forward, and have done a lot of work so far, and I look forward to continuing working with them in the future. Are there any questions?
I do have a question. It's really as someone who has a consumer who has been in a sheltered workshop for, I want to say, 35 years. There are some people, how did you handle it when there was someone who really was older and did not want to move out of the sheltered workshop? And I'm talking about the consumer himself.
Yes.
So what do you do in that situation?
We did have a number of those with the last shelter workshop in Vermont. It was actually, they had a 35-year history of sheltered employment. So a lot of the folks that had been in the workshop had been their life and their career,
right,
since they left high school. So a lot of them, were very reluctant. They didn't know anything other than the sheltered workshop. So once they started doing some more career exploration, getting out and just seeing that there was life outside of the workshop, that's what really changed their minds. One in particular was very much against the workshop closing until he got his job at the mall in a record store, and then he went back and let other people know that he had a job, so he was quite happy about that, and that kind of changed the tone for some of the other folks. And the families had a difficult time with it as well. That was a lot of the focus of the work that I had done, was working with the families and sort of looking and seeing how they navigate the process. And for a lot of them, it's just that they become fairly entrenched in what they know. Those are the only services that they were familiar with. But once they saw that their children and their older adult children getting jobs and being successful, then they kind of changed the attitude. And I'd be happy to forward a short YouTube clip of one of our parents who was one of the people that was most opposed to the workshop converting. She was one of the original founding members of the organization and one of the founding board members. And in this video clip, she just talks about the progress she's seen since the sheltered workshop had closed down, you know, just an increase in skills and community involvement. So now she's one of our, you know, real proponents of the process.
And are we talking about employment that is full-time, or are we talking about some part-time employment? And then what do they do the rest of their day?
Yeah, it's generally part-time employment. Some of the folks have full-time, but given their level of disability, it's more kind of the customized employment that we've developed for folks, like this one man that I mentioned that got the job in the record store. He's, you know, repackages DVDs and CDs as they come in and to, you know, for resale. He's been working there since 2002. He's still there. He's been offered more hours. He actually doesn't want more hours because he's more thinking more of retirement and has other things to do. So if people aren't working, then it's more community-based services. So our Medicaid waiver in Vermont anyway, you know, follows the person. So what they're not using for employment supports, they can use for community-based supports.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. What percentage of people who were working in the sheltered workshops end up with employment?
I can say for this particular agency, when the workshop closed in 2002, it was a smaller group, and a lot of people had already had jobs at that point. Some chose retirement. Others got a job. There may be 15 or 20 that were in the workshop as it was starting to close down, so the numbers weren't huge. But this particular agency right now has a close to 80% employment rate of people that want to work.
Did somebody at DSC, can you tell me how many people are working in the sheltered now?
About 200, just over 200.
Okay. So what percentage of those do you think would you expect would be able to get employment?
Well, offhand, I'd probably say at least 50 to 75% of them can get employment. The work that I've done, you know, other consulting work I've done, you know, when I see sheltered workshops, and I'll use Ohio as an example, that they had 70 people in their sheltered workshop, and I worked with the director, and he identified 35 of them, you know, off the top that he felt could go out and work in the community. And what happens with that is if you have that sheltered workshop model, the sheltered workshop is a business you need to keep running. So, like, you know, he had those 35 people that were, you know, pretty capable workers, you know, but sort of needed them to maintain their contracts. So he had to make the move to kind of reduce those sheltered workshop contracts, and then he was able to move at least those 35 people out in the community. Then there's a percentage that might be more difficult to place into employment. And that's where the customized employment would come in. You know, it's really kind of a carved job specifically for that individual. In Vermont, we've done a fair amount of self-employment for some folks. And then there's going to be a smaller percentage that, based on their disability or medically fragile, or maybe they choose not to work, you know, probably won't be employed. But then what we've done is look at other meaningful activities for them to do if they choose not to be employed.
One last question for me. Mm-hmm. And how much of an increase in staff does it take to supervise or control the additional employees who are working out in the community,
mm-hmm,
versus what we're working in the other area?
Percentage, I'm not sure. It does take more because it's going to be more labor intensive up front, you know, in terms of support and employment and getting people out in the community. But some of the research that has been done, made through Robert Simmer at Kent State University, has studied the concept of supported employment versus sheltered workshops. And what he found is that the initial investment in supported employment is higher, but then over the course of the years, it goes down because you have people earning wages, contributing, you know, reducing their benefits. So So initially it's a higher investment, but over time it reduces. And some of his research also shows that for every dollar that's put in supported employment, you get at least a dollar back, whereas every dollar you put in the shelter workshop stays in the shelter workshop.
Thank you.
I don't want to make this a big issue, but sure. What do you do with a person who's been in a sheltered workshop? You get a part-time job somewhere. What do you do with them for the rest of the day? I don't get what happens with those folks. Do they go, if they're in a SILA, do they go back to a SILA? Do you have other activities that the particular agency has to somehow manage? How does that work?
Well, I can speak on this particular agency in Vermont, the last sheltered workshop. We have individualized budgets for the Medicaid waiver, so individuals would get probably 25 hours of support a week. So what they're not using in employment, they can use in community-based support. So what we do is develop a plan, going through the person-centered planning process of what they would like to do, what they'd like to be involved with at the community. So they still have support to do that through, you know, what's called community inclusion facilitators. So whatever they have in their Medicaid budget, if it funds those 25 hours, what they don't use in employment, they use for community supports. So that could be, you know, involvement in their local gym or horseback riding lessons or different things, you know, based on what their interests are.
Okay. You're gonna have
I'd be happy to talk more later too.
I guess that's one of the points that I think is really important, is it's much easier to offer services to someone new based on what they need and not under the assumption that they need support all day versus a transformation that we're trying to do where people have been able to depend on that for a very long time. That model has worked for a very long time and institutions, shelter, as we become better, not just DSC, but as a social responsibility. The needs change, the trends change. To be responsive to those, we have to redirect services and supports. The way that funding is set up in the state of Illinois doesn't support all of those activities that are outside the day program as it currently exists. Home-based support allows you some flexibility. You heard that there's some limitations to that earlier today in this meeting. But that transformation is the equivalent of less service to a lot of people that have been receiving services basically from 9 to 3 or 8:30 to 2:30 every day. As we begin getting jobs for them and they are working part-time and they need one-on-one support during that time, that leaves less time and less hours and funding available for them to support them. But that's recognizing that DSC is not responsible for filling their full day. That needs to be a shared responsibility, and that is part of the shift. And so that's the challenge, is opening new people that are wanting something different and being able to be responsive to that, and transitioning people that have gotten used to something that's changing. So I think that kind of that's the balance that we're struggling with, but seeing some good successes.
Okay, thanks.
If I could just add one other thing. I've been dealing with a lot of people around the state, Brian mostly, but I think one of the things in Vermont that makes it, they do not do SILAs. They do a host family model.
Right.
And so the host family model, that's where it's picked up. If it's not happening in the day program, that host family is helping connect those other individuals to services in the community to fill the rest of their life. So if the host family's not supporting that, they're connecting to things like the YMCA and to library or whatever that interest that person is. So part of their day is there and not necessarily with the service provider. Is that
right.
correct?
That's right. Yeah,
so I think that tells you, as we're trying to make this shift, when we're based mostly on a SILA model, that makes our challenge even greater, because basically under the SILA model, you've got the 24-hour, and it's a different model. So we have a major challenge that's different than Vermont, but that's one of the reasons that other organizations, including us, are looking at that model and see how we could possibly fit that into this scheme of things too.
So how long has Vermont done individual budgets under their waiver?
Oh, how long? A long time. I think since 1996.
Oh, my gosh. So then I, as a person who can sometimes figure out how to use Google, should be able to find information on how that's worked?
Yeah, I can I can send you our system of care plan and our annual report. That would probably
that would be
a summary of it. Yeah.
That would be great, just for so that I can understand how individual budgeting can be done.
Right.
The state of Illinois is sort of always imploding, and you know there's not talk of infusing more money into DD, so I think we have to sort of accept our waivers as they are at the moment.
Right.
But I would like to understand how this could work.
Yeah, and I'd be happy to put you in touch with a woman, Jenny Masterson. She works for our state developmental disabilities and really knows the Medicaid waiver system really well. And also what the state of Vermont has done, well, since the start in 1980 when we started support employment, it was really a blended model and a cooperative model. So it's voc rehab and developmental services. It's really a blending and braiding of funding and support to ensure employment success for folks. You're welcome.
Okay, we have meeting schedules in the packet. Anyone have any questions or comments about those times or days? Okay, seeing none, let's go on. Ligas Family Advocate Program acronym sheet. Thank you, thank you, thank you. That is so needed, and I do appreciate it. So thank you for that. Any board announcements? Yes.
I have a lot to learn.
Join the crowd. Thank you. I would entertain a motion for adjournment.
So moved. Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
We are adjourned.